What was the Hungarian Gold Train, and how does it fit into Ayelet Waldman's new novel? Ayelet will join us here to talk about her latest book, Love and Treasure.
The Hungarian allies of the Nazis had taken every single thing of value that the Jews had. And when the Russians were invading from the east, they loaded onto this very long cargo train and sent it into the direction of Berlin.
Are writers just too boring for Hollywood? Our Bookends columnists Thomas Mallon and Dana Stevens will be here to talk about why it is so hard to depict writers on screen.
I think I am more in love with a movie like Bright Star, you know, that shows the possibilities and that actually sort of has beautiful language in it.
My colleague John Williams and I will chat about what's new in the book business this week. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Ayelet Waldman is here to talk about her new novel, Love and Treasure. Hi, Ayelet.
Hi, it's such a thrill to be here.
So this is a novel that takes its true story from the Hungarian gold train.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us about that, what
it
was.
It was this remarkable period, sort of episode in history that, you know, I was one of those kids who read hundreds of novels about the Holocaust. And even as an adult, I've read fiction, I've read nonfiction, and I thought I had a fairly accurate sense of all the various elements of what happened in World War II and the Holocaust. And this particular episode in history was completely new to me. The Hungarian gold train was this train full of plunder, essentially the accumulated wealth of the entire Jewish community of Hungary. When the Nazis and their allies in Hungary killed the Jews of Hungary late in the war in the 1940s, the first thing they did before gathering them up into ghettos and sending them off to Auschwitz was confiscate their property piece by piece. So they would issue these edicts. Everyone has to go and turn in their radio. And the Jews would go in line and they'd stand at the post office or they'd stand at the banks and turn in their radios, their bicycles, their jewels, their gold, till bit by bit the Hungarian allies of the Nazis had taken every single thing of value that the Jews had. And then they sort of sorted it and packed it. And when the Russians were invading from the east, they loaded onto this very long cargo train and sent it into the direction of Berlin. I suppose with the idea that it would reach Berlin and Hitler would somehow use the wealth on this train to turn the war around and achieve victory from the jaws of defeat. Estimates of the value range, and if we're talking about in today's dollars, from somewhere between $500 million and $4 billion worth of everything that you can imagine. I mean, stamp collections and diamond tiaras and everything in between.
Right. And how did this come to your attention?
I'm almost embarrassed to tell you it's such a ludicrous story. I knew I wanted to write about the Holocaust. I'd always wanted to, but it took me until this book to actually feel like I had, frankly, the skill to do it.
Because this is your fifth book.
Well, it's my fourth novel, and I had written a series of murder mysteries before. It was like, you know, Malcolm Gladwell says, those 10,000 hours. Until I had enough experience, I just didn't want to. I was afraid of writing something, you know, that kind of awful Holocaust kitsch that we've all read. I didn't want to write something like that. And until I felt like I could treat the subject with the respect it deserved, I avoided it. So finally, I felt like I could. And so I knew that I wanted to write about the Holocaust. I knew I wanted to write about art and painting because I always like to write about something I know nothing about, contrary to Mark Twain's advice, write what you know, which also might have been Faulkner's. No one really knows which of them said that. And I know nothing about art. I used to be one of those people who would look at a Jackson Pollock and say, like, oh, my kid could do that.
Right.
So I really wanted to learn about visual art.
I thought you were going to say, and say, like, I love Matisse. But,
exactly. or, like, I love Manet, but you're actually talking about Monet. Yeah, that's
right.
Me. I took the words Holocaust and art, and then a friend of mine was appointed ambassador to Hungary, and I thought, oh, I can go visit Eleni, and if I write about it, I can deduct it from my taxes. And then I took the word Hungary, and I put those into Google.
Now Google's going to ask for a commission.
I know. They're probably going to have to get like 20% of the profits of this book. Because seriously, I did a Google search. I came up. It took me 3 minutes. And there was this story of this train waiting for me. You know, everyone always likes to think that the muse is this magical thing. My muse is Google and tax avoidance.
I remember when your last book came out, Red Hook Road, which has, as it sort of begins with this tragedy where
right.
a couple, you pulled that out of the newspaper.
Right. Radio. It was on the radio.
Okay.
Michael and I were driving through Queens, I think. We heard this news story and we both looked at each other, my husband, Michael Chabon, and we shouted, dibs at the same time. And then it took us a year of fighting to decide who gets it. Eventually, he conceded that it was far more of an Ayelet story than a Michael story.
This was a couple that died
on the way from the church to the wedding reception.
And now this story of the Hungarian gold train was in the news again not so long ago because it was they finally came to a resolution.
Yeah. So, you know, many, many people stole the items from the train. The contents of the train ultimately ended up in the hands of the American government. Because the U.S. military was occupying Salzburg in Germany at the end of the war. And there was tremendous debate over what to do with all this stuff. There was about half of the Jews of Budapest survived, although only about 10% of the Jews of the Hungarian countryside survived. And the Jewish remnant in Budapest, they wanted their stuff back. I mean, they had actual receipts, you know. The fascists were we all know of the sort of stereotypical efficiency of the Germans and their allies. So the Jews of Hungary had these receipts saying, you know, one gold diadem. So they were saying, give us back our stuff. But at that point, the Soviets were occupying Hungary. And anytime anybody tried to give anything back, the French at some point tried to give back some of the contents that they had in their possession, the Soviets just kept them. So the Americans didn't want to give it to Hungary. They had no faith it would get to the Jews. But the Jews of Hungary wanted their stuff. The international refugee organizations, they wanted it to help pay for the displaced persons, the Jewish Holocaust survivors who were in the camps in Austria and Hungary. The Jews from Palestine wanted the assets so that they could use it to smuggle the DPs over the Alps into Italy, load them on ships where they could run the British blockade of Palestine, like in the movie Exodus.
The deported people.
Yes, exactly.
And
then eventually American military officers started requisitioning stuff from the train. And that's where the lawsuit comes about, because many, many high-ranking American military officers simply took stuff to furnish their houses in Austria. And when they were cycled back home after their terms of service.
So sort of after the Marshall Plan.
Yes, they took it with them. And that was the basis for the lawsuit here in America. And there were a handful of Hungarian survivors who got money from the American government because of that looting, that element of theft. But it is a kind of justice. I mean, but the real tragedy here isn't the 10,000 pairs of silver candlesticks that were stolen. The real tragedy is that 500,000 Hungarian Jews were murdered over the course of about 56 days.
Yeah.
How do you compensate that? You can't.
It's interesting because you choose an object to represent this,
right.
and it's an amulet.
It's like a pendant.
A pendant. Yeah. It reminded me of The Hair with Amber Eyes.
Yes, absolutely. I love that book. That book was a real inspiration for me. You know, there were a lot of things that went into the writing of the book. I think the very first thing, it was the hours. Strangely, which has nothing to do
with
Michael Cunningham's novel. And it was that triptych novel of three sort of parts of a novel that are related thematically and also a little bit with character, but that together comprise this whole. And when I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And then it was The Hair with Amber Eyes, with this remarkable object that then becomes freighted with the weight of the entire tragedy. And that's, again, sort of it was a combination of those things that, so many things go into your inspiration. And for me, a lot of inspiration always comes from the books that I read. I mean, I'm only a writer because I love to read. So it's always me saying, you know what, I really like to write a book like that. I always try to write the book I wish I was reading at the moment. And so after I had just reread The Hours. I read The Hair with Amber Eyes. I read Julia Glass's novel, Three Junes.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I want to write a triptych novel that has at its heart this object. There it was.
So did you take that tax write-off trip
totally.
To
and where
did
is
you
the
go?
IRS listening? Yes, I totally
okay.
did. It was completely legal because I did all my research. So I went to Budapest and did a tremendous. I highly recommend if one is going to a foreign country to do research that one befriend the American ambassador, because it turns out that if you are, friends with the American ambassador, everybody opens their door to you, no matter whether the museum hours are like 9 to 5 or not. She never asked for people to help me, but they were just so incredibly helpful. So I went to Budapest for a couple of weeks. I had the help of this remarkable young graduate student in women's studies who did all my translating for me and got really excited about the project and would.
How did you find her?
The internet, babe. The internet is a glorious
thing. It's all
thing.
About
it's
your
all
Google.
It's all about Google. I like went to the website of, I knew that I wanted to do something vaguely that had to do with the suffrage movement. Perversely, I was doing all this research about women's suffrage in Budapest with this wonderful research assistant who I found because she was a women's studies student at the university in Budapest. And then I found this trove, this photo archive of hundreds and hundreds of photographs of suffragists who had come to the International Conference on Women's Suffrage in Budapest in 1913. Guess where the photographs are? New York at the public library.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
And one of your characters is a suffragist and a dwarf.
Yes. This is in the novel that sort of tells you where this pendant, like, you know, you learn about the search for the owner. You learn about how it got stolen from the train. And then finally, in the final section, you learn to whom it belonged. And yeah, I was writing this section and it was missing there was missing like a little sparkle. It was missing a little magic. It was missing, it had all the pieces, but what was going to lift those pieces to a place where I was really going to find the juice of it was missing. And then my husband came home from McDowell and he had met the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire, which is basically paradise for writers.
Right.
It's like heaven on earth for writers.
Someone stays home and the other person goes to McDowell.
Yeah, exactly. And he came home and he said, I heard a story that is going to rock your world. And there was this group of seven dwarf siblings who were performers. They were vaudevillians and singers in Transylvania before the war. You know, now Romania, then it was Hungary at the time. And they were deported with all the other Jews to Auschwitz. And Mengele was obsessed with the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So he saw these seven siblings, dwarf siblings. He snatched them up. And then
anything that creepy that Mengele was not
obsessed,
with?
Right. Isn't that like so insane that this fairy tale was among the many things that, but what was remarkable about it is that he tortured them. There is no doubt that he tortured, but he also saved them because only,
like the twins,
I mean, they would have been sent, exactly. They would have been sent right to the gas. And they were so smart and, you know, they had such wherewithal in the moment, these people, that they began pointing out others, people from their village, people they knew, and saying, oh, that's our sibling, that's our cousin. Not family members, but they knew that he would be interested in the genetics of it. So they themselves saved all these other people they knew, family members and not, by allowing, you know, by basically bringing them into the fold. And as soon as I read that story, I was like, oh, I need this. This is what I need. And I created, I gave them an extra sibling, one of the siblings, and I made her a suffragist because of course, right? A suffragist dwarf in Budapest in 1913. Every novel needs one.
I feel like we should end there because that's so intriguing and it'll encourage people to read your new novel, which is Love and Treasure, Ayelet Waldman. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
John Williams joins me now to talk a little bit about what's going on in the book business this week.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi, John. It's been a kind of quiet week after a lot of deaths and controversies.
And awards.
Yes.
There have been a lot of headlines lately, so this was a quiet week. But here in New York, it's not very quiet because we have this great festival going on across the city, the 10th annual Penn World Voices Festival, which gathers about 150 writers from 30 countries, and Penn America, which is the organization that fights for dissident writers around the world and does a lot of other literary outreach programs, started this festival 10 years ago. Salman Rushdie is the chairman of it for at least one more year. Next year, Colm Tobin is going to take over for him. And so I went to the opening night on Monday night at Cooper Union, and Rushdie and Noam Chomsky and Judith Butler and several other people gave sort of brief political speeches. And it's just spread out across the whole city. And over the weekend, there's a lot more still to come.
What were the speeches about?
The speeches varied based on, you know, the people's background. Rushdie talked about recent attempts to suppress speech in India. Mm-hmm. An Eastern African political cartoonist named Gatto, who was very entertaining, got up and talked a lot about his work and issues in Africa, including Chinese investment and other controversial things there.
How does the Chinese investment, does that impact the work of writers or?
Well, it's funny. The speeches were not very specifically pegged to writing as a craft. Mm-hmm. It gave these people an opportunity to just talk about things that they thought were important politically. And it was not it was a little bit divorced from, you know, the life of an author. Judith Butler gave a very, very well-received but also very abstract speech about grief and how that turns into political destructiveness. So it really was across the whole spectrum.
And there's a huge and very, very impressive spectrum of writers scheduled to speak at the festival. Who are some of the big
There
names?
Are. I mean, several of them have already spoken. The event started on Monday, but tonight, which is Friday, when people are listening to this, there's a tribute to Dylan Thomas featuring Paul Muldoon and some other writers. And then over the weekend, there are events including Martin Amis, Tracy K. Smith, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Masha Gessen, Salman Rushdie is speaking again with Timothy Garton Ash. So it's really a who's who kind of international literature. And every year they kind of take over the city for a week.
And then it culminates in the big Penn Gala next Monday night.
It does, for those
lucky enough to be going. On a more democratic note, let's talk about this new Harris poll, which looks at America's favorite books.
Yeah, our colleague Jenny Schuessler wrote about this on the Arts blog this week. Harris, which I think is associated with Nielsen, they polled about 2,300 U.S. adults across the country, and they asked them what their favorite book was. And I think the last time they did it was 2008. And so in the 6 years since then, there have been some, I think, pretty significant changes. We've gone from Dan Brown fever to a slightly more, as Jenny puts it, high school curriculum tone to things. The two Dan Brown novels have dropped off the list. Atlas Shrugged did too, which really surprised me. That's
right.
Always
this
very
seems
strong
like it's
on these
an
lists.
Ayn Rand moment with the libertarian rise of the Tea Party and
yes,
Rand Paul.
Yes, exactly. The other
maybe
side.
They've already all read it, and it was a split decision between that and The Fountainhead.
Exactly. They got rid of that. And what was the fourth one that dropped off the list? Oh, Stephen King's The Stand also dropped off the list. And the ones that replaced the four that dropped off are Moby Dick, Little Women, The Grapes of Wrath, and The Great Gatsby, which really does sound like a summer reading program for rising juniors or something.
It warms my heart.
Yes, and, no, it's good news for us traditionalists.
It's funny because when I look, let's go down the list for those who don't have it in front of them. The big surprise winner is The Bible at number one. And then number two, Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. Number three, Harry Potter, the series. The Lord of the Ring, the series, is number four. At five, we have everyone's seventh grade assignment classic, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Moby Dick by Herman Melville. It's interesting. I mean, I love that book, but I wonder how many people actually read it or feel like they ought to
have.
Yeah,
I feel like there are a handful of people I know in the last few years who decided to read it as a kind of project, but it surprises me that there's such a broad consensus that it's one of people's most beloved books at this point.
Have you read Moby Dick?
I read portions of it in high school. They didn't make us read the whole thing, and I've gone back and I read the first half a few years ago, but I put it away. I was enjoying it, but I just had a lot of other reading to do.
There were other things to read. I remember reading it in 1992 on a beach in Thailand.
Wow, that's quite a place to read.
Seemed sort of appropriate and sort of really not the place. Other people were not reading Moby Dick on the beach in Thailand, most other people. At number seven, one of my least favorite novels, I will just come out and say it, The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. Number eight, Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. Number nine, Grapes of Wrath. And then at 10, The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, and The Grapes of Wrath just celebrated a big anniversary, so that's probably going to stay on people's radars for a while.
Right,
and,
75th anniversary?
Yeah, 75th anniversary. And it's funny, when you name the series Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings, those have switched. I think those will probably have an ongoing battle of jockeying for position. In 2008, The Lord of the Rings was third and Harry Potter was fourth, and now they've switched. So I think that people probably are fickle in which one they prefer on any given day. What surprised me was, and they break this down by gender, by age, by ethnicity, by political affiliation, and The Bible, I think, wins in all of those categories. And so they sort of did the second favorites by demographic. And I was just surprised that the baby boomers, that their favorite book is Gone with the Wind. When I think of people who are in their late 40s to mid 60s, I just don't picture them picking that book up now. But I guess maybe that's also a youthful experience they had with it.
That youthful longing for a nostalgic view of, horrible pre-Civil War era South. A little disturbing maybe in some ways. Let's just make this personal. Which is your favorite and least favorite book on the list, John?
On this list? Wow. I have not read all of these books, but I'm not a big fantasy person, so I never read The Lord of the Rings or the Harry Potter series. My favorite is probably The Great Gatsby. I liked Catcher in the Rye more than you did, but I haven't read it in so long. I'd say Gatsby is probably my favorite. Least favorite? I don't have a least favorite of the ones I've read. I like them all.
We'll end on that sweet note.
How about
no
you?
No bad reviews.
You don't like Salinger.
John, so I don't like Salinger, and I don't like The Great Gatsby. So never say that we all think alike here at The Book Review. All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
This week in the Bookends column, Thomas Mellon and Dana Stevens answer the question, or try to answer the question, why is it so hard to capture the writer's life on film? Joining me now are Tom Mellon. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And Dana Stevens. Hi, Dana.
Hey, Pamela.
Why is it so hard? Or is it so hard?
I think Tom gets at something when he says somewhere in his piece that, who is it? Is it Martin Amis that says a writer is most himself when he's alone?
Yes.
Right? I mean, every movie about an individual writer is going to be faced with that problem, that writing itself, as every writer knows, is the most claustrophobic, boring, static, stationary activity there could possibly be.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the real act of writing goes on all the time. It's something that you're doing usually before you sit down at the typewriter. I mean, more comes to me when I'm walking or riding my bike, I think, than actually comes to me at my desk. By the time I'm actually ready to write something, it's almost more like rewriting it. I don't think it's very dramatic, certainly not visually.
So I have been rewatching in little chunks at night Adaptation, which I hadn't seen since it had came out. And neither of you mentioned it in your piece, maybe because it's screenwriting as opposed to novel writing. But I thought, actually, that film does a really good job of depicting writers on film, the sort of that angst of Nicolas Cage's character portraying the actual screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, in the movie. And the way in which, I don't know if you recall, when he's sort of trying to figure out how he's going to adapt Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, into film, they show him sort of narrating, and you see the images kind of go in this hyper-fast montage, and then redoing it again as he kind of rewrites that scene.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Adaptation, because I almost wrote on Adaptation instead of Barton Fink,
which is the movie I chose to focus on.
I knew I wanted to do a deep dive into one movie, because it wasn't enough space to do a kind of survey of writers on film. And Adaptation was the other one that really seemed like it did something unusual with all of these cliches that we associate with writers on film, right? With writer's block and staring at the blank page and clickety-clack and all the things I talk about in Barton Fink. Adaptation takes them in a completely different direction, of course, much more surreal and interior and kind of building alternate realities out of the writer's imagination. That would have been a great one to take on, too.
You know, the other thing I loved about Adaptation was that it takes on not only the sort of that internal process, but also like the critic that lives inside every writer's head. And I loved the fact that they create the twin character, I think Don, or the sort of Charlie Kaufman's fake twin, who's this total hack of a writer who then, you know, enjoys enormous success and has, you know, the contrast between Charlie Kaufman / Nicolas Cage's angsty, you know, intellectualized process, and then this hapless twin who says, you know, like, I'm going to create a serial killer who's a multiple personality, you know, and this just sort of horrible amalgam of cliches.
Well, I mean, I think directors are always looking for new things to do visually. I mean, I mentioned Limitless, this not very good Bradley Cooper movie. And I mentioned the words start coming and they're shiny, whatever. In the movie, they're literally shiny. They show you words that, you know, start dancing around the screen. It helps that the character's on drugs when that actually happens. But I think, you know, the effects that directors can come up with, or the auteur can manage to figure out, I mean, they can be striking, but they're just limited by the physical situation of the writer at a keyboard.
You mentioned a few, including Limitless and The Hours, that I think are, as you say, limited. Limitless is limited in its ability to show the scope of a writer's imagination. But what movies do you think succeed?
Some of them, like Deconstructing Harry, is the Woody Allen movie. I mean, it's funny, it's kind of broad, the comedy, but it does actually get to certain situations that writers actually face.
Yes.
Namely, you know, what to do if you put family members and friends and ex-lovers into something. And, I mentioned, it'll occur to anybody who watches that movie that there's a Fellini aspect to it. Maybe film directors going into their own paths and into the act of doing film do this better. I mean, one of my favorite movies of all time is Fellini's movie, Amarcord, where he shows you how all of his youthful memories, accrued and became something that he put into his art. But if you have a writer who's in the world, a writer who's struggling and a writer who's battling politically or who's just battling agents and editors and critics and all of those things. Obviously, that has dramatic potential. I don't think it's a problem to depict an author's life so much. It's just the act of writing that is so difficult for, I think, movies to capture.
Yeah, and maybe that's why you're right. If it's a writer who's turned more outward and who has some element as well of being sort of a pundit or a social actor in some way. I mean, a movie about a writer that I really love is Wilde, the Oscar Wilde biopic that's based on the Richard Ellman biography.
Too.
Isn't that a good movie?
It is a good
movie. The casting of Stephen Fry as Oscar Wilde is absolutely perfect, and he really understands and knows his work. You can tell in his performance.
Okay, I'm going to have to digress a little bit about the writing thing and talk about the casting, because also Jude Law as Bosie is perfect. I think that was either his first role or his first big role.
Certainly the first time he ever struck me, and I still think of that as an essential Jude Law role.
Yeah, and Michael Sheen as the sort of, I can't remember his name now, his character's name, but the person who first initiates Oscar Wilde into his, you know, allows him to acknowledge his homosexuality. Tom Wilkinson, oddly, as Bosie's father.
Jennifer Ely as
the great
Oscar Wilde's
Jennifer
wife.
Ely, yes. It's just it's a great film, but I guess it's really more less about the writing itself and more about sort of everything that surrounds it.
Right. And it also focuses on a specific moment in Wilde's life, which I think in general for biopics is a smart thing to do and seems to be a direction in which biopics are moving. Actually, Bright Star, which I talk about briefly in my piece, the John Keats biopic by Jane Campion, also focuses very narrowly on this romance that he had late in life with Fanny Braun and is a wonderful, I think, movie about a writer's life and also some about the act of writing.
Yeah, I mean, the consequences of writing are easy enough to depict. You know, if a book has personal consequences, political consequences, whatever. So in a sense, once the writer's kind of back out in the world, the opportunities open up.
As long as you ignore the writing part, it's all okay. It's about, but I mean, I guess what we're saying is that the creative process can be shown in an interesting way, whether it's an amacord or adaptation. The whole sort of context around the writer, I think, as you said, with Deconstructing Harry, the reception, the social consequences of writing, and the life of the writer, just as long as you don't show that, like, horrible tapping at the keyboard.
You know, and if you think of, we so often identify writers with their milieu, with their time, with their place. And if you think of, you know, writers in the 20s and all of the opportunities for Paris and New York and jumping into fountains at the Plaza, all of that. It's all the stuff that really surrounds the writing that I think has mostly appealed to movie makers. I mean, if you're going to show Hemingway on screen, the least interesting thing about him will be his time at the keyboard. It's going to be, you know, when he's out picking up a gun or, you know, going off to Spain.
Didn't Dorothy and the Vicious Circle have some aspect of, like, sort of type on screen? Am I misremembering that? Like, where you actually, I think that there's been some things that have been done creatively using a bit of animation showing the sort of the print on screen as
that
it's being
happened. I don't remember that in the Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle.
Mrs. Parker.
But it may have been there, but that happened just recently in the Great Gatsby, in the Baz Luhrmann Great Gatsby that tried to imagine Nick as the author of the Great Gatsby, and there was a lot of floating type and things like that. And I thought it was sort of hokey in that movie. But then I'm just thinking of some of the wildly different things you can do with the act of typing. As in Naked Lunch, Cronenberg's Naked Lunch,
right,
about William Burroughs, which has the typewriters turn into these awful organic beings and, you know, just sort of animates that experience in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah,
right.
I mean,
once again, drugs are involved.
Yeah, drugs help.
All right. Maybe just before we go, Tom, you said your favorite movie depicting a writer or the creative process is Amarcord. Am I getting that?
I think so. I mean, it's clearly, Fellini, you know, in film did a lot about he did an awful lot of movie making about movie making, but with Amarcord, it's really not so much how the actual movies got made, but all of the memories of his childhood that went into what came later. You have to know something in a way about Fellini to, you know, make that connection. But I think in terms of a writer dealing with autobiography, that's one of my very favorite films.
And your favorite movie about a writer? Is it Barton Fink?
I don't know that that's my favorite. I just felt that that would be a great one to explore in the context of, you know, with the limits as an actual writer and a lover of writing. I don't think my favorite movie about a writer is ultimately going to be one that's so cruel and so negative about the act of writing as Barton Fink is. I think I am more in love with a movie like Bright Star, you know, that shows the possibilities and that actually sort of has beautiful language in it. Because when Barton Fink does finally produce his screenplay, or when we look back on the successful play he had, they're kind of awful and they're kind of objects of derision. So I don't think I could quite elevate that to the top post.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Tom Mallon and Dana Stevens in this week's Bookends column, which is about why it is so hard to capture the writer's life on film. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dana, thanks so much.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here now with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
There's a lot of churn on the list this week, starting over on the fiction side of the hardcover list, where there are six new titles. Down at number 15, a guy named Andrew Gross has his first hardcover bestseller. It's called Everything to Lose. The interesting thing about Andrew Gross, he's a thriller writer. He has had a mass market paperback bestseller before, but he also is a five-time co-writer with James Patterson and made the list many times, I think all five of those times with James Patterson. As far as I could tell a couple years ago when I looked into this, Andrew Gross is the only one of all 16 of James Patterson's co-writers to that point ever to make the list on his own without James Patterson.
James Patterson helps.
Then at number 14... our own Bookends columnist Francine Prose is new on the list with her new novel that's called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, comma, Paris 1932. It is a look at cross-dressers and Nazi collaborators in France during the World War II years.
And reviewed on our cover by Edmund White.
Then jumping up to number six, Amanda Quick, who is really Jane Ann Krentz writing under the pseudonym Amanda Quick, which is what she uses when she writes her historical suspense romance.
Are you like
novels.
A secret database of pseudonyms for various genre?
Yes, Pamela, I am. So Amanda Quick is new on the list with a book called Otherwise Engaged, and that is about a serial killer known as the Bridegroom. Then at number five, Christopher Moore, bestseller regular, has his latest kind of Shakespearean farce. It's called The Serpent of Venice. Then at number three, the late Maeve Binchy. I don't know if we're allowed to say late when somebody's died a couple of years ago. Maeve Binchy, who died in 2012, has a story collection called Chestnut Street. And these are stories that she worked on through the course of her career and just kind of tabled. And after her death, her publisher went through and found 36 of them. They're characters who sometimes made their way into her novels, visiting again the Dublin life that she always wrote about. Mm-hmm. And new at number one this week, David Baldacci starts out right at the top of the list with a book called The Target. Then on the nonfiction side of things, there are three new titles. Down at number 16, the former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens has his book Six Amendments. That is where he proposes, as the title says, six amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And he also uses the book as the occasion to really take issue with some recent Supreme Court decisions. Alone among the living former Supreme Court justices, he has been fairly feisty in criticizing the court as it stands now. Then at number three, the Good Morning America anchor Robin Roberts has a memoir that she wrote with Veronica Chambers. It's called Everybody's Got Something. That phrase is advice that her mother used to give her, both to say if Robin Roberts was complaining about something, mm-hmm. her mother would say, hey, everybody's got something. But she also would turn it around to mean everybody's got something to offer and to help you through the tough times that you're going through.
And ever the optimist.
Exactly right. And then at number two, Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator. Weirdly, she became the senior senator from Massachusetts once John Kerry was appointed Secretary of State, and suddenly the state that had a Ted Kennedy for decades has two kind of brand new senators. Elizabeth Warren now is the senior senator from Massachusetts. She has a memoir called A Fighting Chance that is truly a memoir. It goes back and looks at how she got into politics, her work as a law professor, fighting for more liberal bankruptcy laws, and her support for poor people in the working class. In some ways, it feels a bit like a campaign book, but she doesn't talk about 2016 at all, and she said she's not interested in running for president.
Well, it seems like the perfect contrast, I guess, to Michael Lewis's ongoing perch at number one. We've got the high income and the very low income.
Yeah, although, of course, Michael Lewis also is taking on the people who are making big, big money on Wall Street. It reflects a little bit of, I'd say a populist trend on the nonfiction list right now. Thomas Piketty is still there with Capital in the 21st Century, looking at inequality as a big problem.
And The Divide, Matt Taibbi.
Exactly, looking at inequality as a big problem.
All right. Well, we know what the problem is. Next week, the solution. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.